You know, as you go through life and you go through the many challenges that we face, you realize that one of the proofs of God's existence, his existence, is the miracles that occur. You go back to the New Testament church and you see multiple miracles that would take place. You go back to, again, what we talked about in the Bible study, and you see that it was a miracle of God for the Israelites to come across the Red Sea in one evening. We witness and we see the many miracles that Jesus Christ performed in his 3.5-year ministry and the healings that would take place, the demon-possessed people that would have the demons removed from them, the afflictions that many had, the lepers that were cleansed, the multiple individuals that needed to be healed. And you come to realize there are a multitude of miracles that take place. You know, sometimes we take God's miracles for granted. Other times we wonder, where is God's miracles? And are we living in a time in which there simply are no miracles? Or in other words, is the day of miracles simply past? Is that something that happened and occurred during Jesus Christ's time? Is that something that happened during the time of Moses, happened during the time of Elijah, happened during, again, the time of Jesus Christ's ministry? You don't see those same miracles happening today. And so we ask the question, do miracles still exist? I'd like to talk about that a little bit this afternoon. The title for the sermon this afternoon is Miracles of God, and I would like to frame this particular sermon by telling you a story. Again, as I've said before, that when I return from camp, I have much fodder for messages that I could use to go multiple weeks. There are many things that happened over the last 2 weeks that I could share with you with the spiritual principles and analogies that we can draw from them. There was one such thing that happened during the extended session, actually happening before the extended session. Now, let me explain that a little bit so that you understand what I'm talking about. You are familiar with the term Camp Sequoia. It is one of our youth camps that takes place in California. What is unique about Camp Sequoia is there is also an extended session that takes place 4 days after the camp ends. The camp ends on Sunday, and then we have an extended session that runs from Sunday all the way through Thursday. This was my 5th extended session, and during an extended session, we normally take 16, 17, and 18-year-olds. This is designed for the older teens in camp. Over that period of 5 years, we have gone to a variety of different places on extended session. It is always a backpacking trip that we take, but there are different locations that we have gone to. We have gone multiple times up to Sequoia National Forest. We have gone twice to Catalina Island. Catalina Island was a memorable trip for the staff in 2015 when we went there. I have been hiking. I have gone on, this is, again, my 5th extended session. I've gone on 4 Young Adult Challenger programs. I've hiked in the Wind Rivers in Wyoming. I've hiked rim to rim the Grand Canyon. In all of that time, I have never gotten blisters on my feet. And in 2015, when we went to Catalina Island, I had blisters everywhere, all over my feet. I believe it is a California curse. The extended session, again, is something that is unique every year to Camp Sequoia. This year was no different. We had made plans months in advance, in fact, going all the way back to January, to take the 13 young people that had signed up and been accepted for extended session, along with Mr. Carter, who is the camp director, and myself, the program director for Camp Sequoia, and our plan was to go to Yosemite. Now, that sparked a lot of interest so much to the standpoint that we actually had several that were on a waiting list that if anybody would drop out, they wanted to go. We knew that we were in trouble early in the week because on Tuesday, we ended up getting a notification. Again, I had limited email access while at camp. We had limited internet, but there was a fire. They referred to it as the Ferguson Fire in Yosemite that was burning. Now, it was well south of the intended area that we were planning to go to. There is a road, and I can't remember if it's State Road 140 or 120. I don't remember. It's not important to the story. But we knew that if the fire advanced past that road, we were going to have a problem. The other problem we're going to have is if the fire did advance and we were able to go across on that road to get in, what if the fire then advanced and shut off that road? Then we were isolated and cut off. This was all coming at us on Tuesday. Mr. Carter was telling me about what was going on, what was happening, and I said, well, what are we going to do? We have to wait and see. We have to wait and see. It's too early to determine. As the week progressed, I could tell that we were in a bad way with the situation. By Wednesday, we got the news report that the fire had only been 9% contained. 24 hours later, it was 17% contained. And you don't have to be a mathematician to figure out that 8% in 24 hours is not going to get you where you need to be. The fire was advancing too quick. By Saturday evening, when we pulled it up, we realized that we were in trouble and we did not know what we were going to do. They had shut down the Yosemite Valley. Now, we've got people that are coming in from around the nation. We've got people that have come in from California. We've got people that have come in from Texas. We've got people that have come in from Indiana, from Georgia. And to simply tell them, sorry, tell your parents to make reservations or change your reservations, you're flying home early, is not going to work. On Sunday morning, when we got out of the camp and made our way down to Porterville, California, we were able to finally have, again, cell phone service so that we could contact the park rangers and find out what the situation was in Yosemite. They indicated at that time that, again, Yosemite was still closed. They did not see Yosemite opening up anytime soon. We explained where we were going, which was in the north end of Yosemite, not the valley, but in the north end of Yosemite that had not yet closed. We asked the question, how far is it advanced and is it close to that particular state route? She said, it is threatening that route. She said, what is your plan as far as Sunday evening? We said, well, we have reservations at this particular campground for our orientation before we begin our hike on Monday. She says, that campground is closed. Your money will be refunded to you. At that particular point, we asked her the question, what is the air quality like? She said, it is very poor. We asked the question, if we were to come in and skirt around Yosemite and come in from the north, could we use that particular area? She said, I would not advise it. The air quality is extremely poor. So Sunday morning, as we're sitting there in Taco Bell, my indigestion is not just from the tacos I was eating, but also trying to figure out with Mr. Carter what we were going to do with 13 young people scheduled for an extended session backpacking trip. We made the determination that we would head up to Sequoia National Forest. We had been there on three separate occasions before. We knew the area. We had hiked the area. So we were familiar with the area and felt like perhaps if we could get up there in time, we could somehow get a permit. Now, to understand a little bit of the problem that you've got, it's not like you or you and a friend or you and your spouse or two or three people going up to hike. We had 15 people in a group. To put that in perspective, how many times when you go to a restaurant and you say, you know, how many, and you got to put your name in, you know, two? Well, we can seat you in 5 minutes. I've got 15 people, that's going to be 2 hours. To get 15 people into the national park during the summertime, which is their busiest time, with no reservations, would not be impossible, but I would put it at right next to impossible. We got up to Sequoia National Forest, the main area there that is called Lodgepole. We went into the ranger station there at Lodgepole. We asked the question, can we go on this one particular route that we had gone last year? We knew the route. She said, how many people do you have? We said, 15. She said, you can't take 15 people up there. We said, what about this particular area coming in the opposite way? She said, well, you can go up part of the way, but when you get to this one particular lake, you can't have 15 people at that particular lake. Well, that's not going to work either. There was one more route that we had that we knew that we could take. It was a 7-mile route in. We would camp at the lake, make it a base camp for 2 days, and do a day hike over to another lake. We said, what about to Twin Lakes? Will that work? Let me check. Yeah, that's available. We'll take it. We got our permit, but now we still have another problem because we've got 15 people and we have to find a place to stay Sunday evening. And again, like I said, this is not like getting a table for two. This is like getting a table for 15 people. There was a campground that's right there at Lodgepole. She said, you'll have to check with them. I have no data on that. We went in. The person just laughed and said, there's no way. I don't have anything available. We had stayed at another campground the year before we had done a hike in Sequoia. So we went out in that direction. It's about 20 minutes away from where we were, from the trailhead that we would go to and start on Monday morning. As we turned off the main highway into where the campground is, the sign said full. We said, let's try it anyways. We got to the ranger station there where the campground was, went up to the window, asked if there were any campsites available. The ranger said, I think we might have. How many people do you have? And we said, 15. She said, we've got two campsites, but you can only have 12 people, six people a campsite. Mr. Carter said, well, we've got 15. She said, well, I'll let it slide. We were able to get the two campsites. She said, oh, by the way, she said, they're right together as well. Now, these were, I still don't know how that, because you normally, with co-ed, you're going to set up guys one section, girls one section. And as it was the last night, we had to do something different. But anyways, on that particular moment, we were able to have our orientation, have everybody together. We made our way again through the next morning on our three-day journey. We came back. After we came back, once we got back Wednesday evening, again, we have to go to the same thing. We've got no reservations. We've got to stay somewhere Wednesday evening. Now, you've just come off the trail. You've been on sleeping on the ground for four nights. The last thing you want to do is have to worry and wonder about where you're going to be sleeping that night. We went back to Lodgepole, to the campground. I've got nothing available. Do you have anything indoors? She said, well, it looks like on the computer they said there are three available, but she said by the time you get there, they're going to be gone. Mr. Carter and I talked about it because our tradition normally when we go to Sequoia National Forest is to, again, treat the kids to cheeseburgers, fries, and ice cream after they come off the trail. It's sort of a treat of having had freeze-dried food for 3 days and trying to get your body back to somewhat semblance of normalcy with all the other stuff that you've been eating. Nothing like sugar and fat and everything else to go along with that to make your body feel better. So we came to the decision. We said, well, it was 4:30, and we said, should we go ahead and go now, or should we wait, eat dinner here, and then just go ahead and go to the campground and see if they have anything available? And I said, well, what are our options if they don't have anything available? And he said, well, the park ranger says we can do disbursement camping. For those of you that don't know what disbursement camping is, that means you just go find some place in the woods. You have no water. You have no pit toilet. You have nothing. Now, if it's just me, I'm fine with that. But with 13 teenagers, I ain't doing that. I said, Mr. Carter, let's get this camp thing squared away. Let's get the campsite squared away. So we, 20 minutes, made our way to the campground. Walk in. There's a grandfatherly, gentleman-like park ranger. Said, you got any space available? Again, the sign was out front, full. He says, I could probably fit you in. He says, I got a few spaces. He said, how many people do you have? We said, 15. He said, there's no way. It's 12. Mr. Carter said, are you sure it's only 12? He says, I'm going to let you stay. He says, if you guys make any noise and there are complaints, I don't know you. So we reminded the kids we were there, don't say anything at night, at quiet time. Don't say anything. We're over our capacity. Now, I shared with this with you for a reason. Because what we witnessed with this extended session this year was miracle after miracle. When you consider and you understand the dynamics of what you're trying to do, and when you understand the venue that you're trying to get into, when you realize the group that you're trying to deal with, you come back to realize that there was a higher power at work there that saw you through. There is no way that you should be able to get into a national forest, into a campground, onto a trail with 15 people half a day before you're supposed to get there. When people are calling up on January 2nd when they first open up to make reservations. We ask the question, do we take God's miracles for granted? Or sometimes are those miracles closer than we realize, and perhaps we just dismiss them? As we look at the New Testament church, we see multiple miracles occurring, and too often we find that people will tie the miracles just to healings. Now, there's no question about that. If you go through the gospel accounts, you see time after time that miracles occurred by Jesus Christ performing those miracles, And many of them are tied to healings. But not just to healings. Turn with me over to John chapter 2. You see, the miracles are not just about healings. Sometimes they're about campsites. Sometimes they're about hiking permits. Sometimes they're about intervention of a job. Sometimes they're about intervention of being able to get off for the feast. Sometimes they're simply about being able to get along with somebody that you have to work with. My point is that miracles are occurring all the time if we take notice of them. I was witness to that this past week. It reminded me of the power of God, and it reminded me that we never should let ourselves down in realizing that God still works miracles today. Yes, the magnitude of miracles that occurred during the time of Moses, Elijah, and Christ was of a great magnitude. But just because we don't see miracles happening with the same magnitude today, does that mean that the day of miracles has passed? And are the miracles simply tied to the healing that we see when a person is healed? John chapter 2, notice verse 1. We find three instances here that I'm going to share with you of miracles, and none of them have to do with healing. The first we find is the one recorded of Jesus Christ when he would change the water to wine. Here we find him the third day, verse 1, chapter 2. Was a wedding in Cana of Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. Now both Jesus and the disciples were invited to the wedding. And when they ran out of wine, the mother of Jesus said to him, "They have no wine." He already perceived and knew what she wanted him to do. His statement in verse 4, Jesus said to her, "Woman, what does your concern have to do with me? My hour is not yet come." I'm not ready to manifest myself yet. There's still work that needs to be done. You're asking me to do something that's going to put it out there that how did this person do what he did? His mother said to the servants, "Whatever he says to you, do it." Now there were set 6 water pots of stone according to the manner of purification of the Jews, containing 20 or 30 gallons apiece. Jesus said to them, "Fill the water pots with water," and they filled them up to the brim. And he said to them, "Draw some out now and take it to the master of the feast." And they took it. The master of the feast had tasted the water that it was made wine and did not know where it came from, but the servants had drawn the water knew. The master of the feast called the bridegroom, and he said to him, "Every man at the beginning sets out the good wine, and when the guests have well drunk, then the inferior. You have kept the good wine until now." This beginning of signs Jesus did in Cana of Galilee and manifested his glory, and his disciples believed in him. You know, to look at it from the power of quality, they were expecting the two-buck chuck. For those of you that don't know what that is, that's Charles Shaw. That's the cheap stuff, right? But it was the good stuff, and the good stuff takes some time. You know, for those people that don't understand wine, certain wine has to be aged, it has to be treated a certain way, and that's why they can charge more for it. I remember years ago when we were having a wine tasting back in Indiana, this is back decades ago, there's a widow that we knew in the church, and we would give her a hard time because she really didn't know anything about wine. We had a wine tasting, and somebody had brought, it's called Night Train Express. I think you get it at 7-Eleven. It's just this fortified wine. So we poured a little in it and gave it to her, and she said, "Oh, I don't like that. I don't have a taste for fine wine." We're like, "No, that's not fine wine." Here's a miracle that occurred, and it was a miracle over the power of the quality of something. Had nothing to do with healing. It was a miracle of the power of quality. Let's turn over to John chapter 6. Let's go to another couple of miracles here. John chapter 6. In John chapter 6, we find a great multitude. And again, as you see the mercy and compassion, remember what I said, that John tends to write from the standpoint of compassion and mercy in his gospel account of Jesus Christ. When Jesus Christ would look out upon the multitudes that he was teaching, he would look upon them with compassion and mercy. In this case, he saw that they were hungered. He saw that they needed bread. They needed something to eat. So he is going to here ask for help, wanting to know where we should get the bread, how much we should eat. He already knew that, but it was a test. Philip makes the statement in verse 7. He says, Philip answered him, 200 denarii worth of bread is not sufficient for them, that every one of them may have a little. One of his disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, said to him, there is a lad here who has 5 barley loaves and 2 small fishes, but what are they among so many? The word or the phrase so many is an understatement when you read the next verse. Then Jesus said, make the people sit down. Now there was much grass in the place, so the men sat down, in number about 5,000. You can go to commentaries that will tell you that was just the count of the men, not considering the women, perhaps the children were with them. Estimates put it somewhere between 12 and 15,000 people. 5 loaves and 2 fishes, we're going to get that done. Verse 11, and Jesus took the loaves, and when he had given thanks, he had distributed them to the disciples, and the disciples to those sitting down, and likewise the fish as much as they wanted. So when they were filled, he said to his disciple, gather up the fragments that remain so that nothing is lost. They filled it up. They filled up 12 baskets. You feed 12 to 15,000 people and you still have 12 baskets left over. That is a miracle. It is a miracle that Jesus Christ performed, showing power over quantity. Again, it has nothing to do with healing, but it was still a miracle. Let's look at one more example quickly here. In verse 16, we find that after everything was said and done, the disciples went down to the sea, they got into the boat, and they made their way again across towards Capernaum. Verse 18, then the sea arose because a great wind was blowing. So when they had rowed about 3 or 4 miles, they saw Jesus walking on the sea and drawing near to the boat, and they were afraid. And he said to them, it is I, do not be afraid. Then they willingly received him into the boat, and immediately the boat was at the land where they were going. This is another miracle that occurred. It showed the power over natural law. Nobody has the ability to walk on water. Oh, I know some people have some egos that think they can walk on water, but that's a metaphorical statement and not a literal statement. Even the shallowest puddle that we find in the Pacific Northwest, you cannot walk across. Your feet will find the bottom. So here in John chapter 2, John chapter 6, we find 3 miracles. These are miracles of substantial proportions, and not one of them involved healing someone. Not one of them involved healing someone. Jesus Christ made a profound statement to his disciples. I want you to turn over to Matthew chapter 10. Matthew chapter 10, notice beginning here in verse 5, he is going to send out the 12 disciples. He is going to send them out to do certain things. He gives them specific instructions as far as what they are to be doing. Let's pick it up here in verse 5, Matthew chapter 10. He says, these 12 Jesus sent out and commanded them, saying, do not go into the way of the Gentiles and do not enter a city of the Samaritans, but go rather to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. And as you go, preach, saying, the kingdom of heaven is at hand. Heal the sick, miracle. Cleanse the lepers, miracle. Raise the dead, miracle. Cast out demons, that is a miracle. Freely you have received, freely give. Provide neither gold nor silver nor copper in your money belts, nor bag for your journey, nor 2 tunics, nor staffs, nor sandals, nor staffs, for a worker is worthy of his food. He gave them the instructions. He told them and gave them the power of what they would have the ability to do. Was it just for that time? Notice verse 23. He talks about the fact that, he speaks in times of the future here, where he talks about the fact that in verse 18, you'll be brought before governors and kings for my sake as testimony to them and the Gentiles. He talks about the fact that they will deliver up to you and not to worry about what you should speak, that it will be given to you at that particular time, at that particular hour, what you should say. He said that brother will deliver up brother to death, sister will deliver up sister to death, child against child, child against parents. Conflict, chaos, you'll be persecuted, you'll be hated for my name's sake. Notice what he says on verse 23. Remember the context, we're going back to verses 5 and 8, where he talks about what they were going to go out and do, these miracles that were going to be performed. Verse 23, when they persecute you in this city, flee to another. For assuredly I say to you, you will not have gone through the cities of Israel before the Son of Man comes. That's a prophetic statement. Jesus Christ has not returned yet. I don't care what an evangelical tells you, that it's just Jesus in your heart. He's already here. So does that mean that the miracles that the 12 performed was just simply for that particular time? In verse 23, I tell you that's not the case. That miracles still will be performed. Miracles still are performed. And it's not just for them now. It is for us today. Go back and read it again. For assuredly I say to you, you will have not gone through the cities of Israel before the Son of Man comes. He was speaking to the people of that time, but the correlation for us is no different. Oftentimes, because we see a lack of miracles, we wonder where God is. Or perhaps we don't see the magnitude of the miracle, and we wonder where God is. This came to my mind this week. It made me wonder if perhaps we have lost something in terms of thinking about the miracles of God and the fact that those miracles are still being performed. Others believe that if a miracle occurs, it's simply a coincidence. People outside the church would believe it's somehow satanic in origin, satanic in nature. If we want that miracle to occur, what is it? Is there a prerequisite, a responsibility that we have? Let's go over to Luke chapter 18. Luke chapter 18. Luke chapter 18. My Bible has a chapter heading here of the unjust judge, but there's a statement that is made here, and I want to draw together two verses out of what we're going to read. So let's read these first. Luke chapter 18, beginning in verse 1, he says, "Then he spoke a parable to them, that men always ought to pray and not lose heart, saying, there was in a certain city a judge who did not fear God nor regard man. Now there was a widow in that city, and she came to him saying, get justice for me from my adversary. And he would not for a while, but afterward he said within himself, though I do not fear God nor regard man, yet because this widow troubles me, I will avenge her, lest by her continually coming she weary me." If we have not seen miracles occur, I ask the question, are we wearying God in prayer? Then the Lord said, "Hear what the unjust judge said, and shall God not avenge his own elect who cry out day and night to him, though he bears long with them? I tell you that he will avenge them speedily. Nevertheless, when the Son of Man comes, will he really find faith on the earth?" I posed this question to someone years ago, another minister, another pastor. I said, "When the Son of Man comes, will he find faith on this earth?" And the individual said, "Yes, he will." And I said, "I agree, but to what extent? To what degree?" If you correlate verses 5 and 8 together, "Nevertheless, when the Son of Man comes, will he really find faith in this earth?" And verse 5, "Yet because this widow troubles me, I will avenge her, lest by her continually coming she weary me." I ask the question, if we have not seen miracles, if we have not seen things happen, is it because we have not been persistent, relentless in our prayer to God? Her belief did not stop from the time that she was asking. It was continual. Notice over in James chapter 5. James chapter 5. Context of James chapter 5 and the two verses that we're going to read here, again, we look at those who are ill, those who are sick, but there's something more that I think is in the context of what we're going to read here. Let's begin in verse 15. James chapter 5, and notice verse 15. He says, "And the prayer of faith will save the sick, and God will raise him up. And if he has committed sins, he will be forgiven. Confess your trespasses to one another and pray for one another that you may be healed. The effective, fervent prayer of a righteous man avails much. What is effective? What is fervent? Is it a one-time occurrence? I will tell you that as I sat in that van with 10 girls and one other guy, all of them singing along to Taylor Swift, driving me crazy, lipping to Mr. Carter, "Help me," as he was going in and trying to find out if we could get a campsite, I was fervent. I don't want all of these people. I don't want us to disbursement camp. It was as fervent as I could be at that particular moment in time. Now, I'm not going to sit here and say that I'm a righteous man and that therefore my prayer availed much. I will simply tell you that my petition to God was probably realized for the sake of sanity of the staff that was on with the kids. You get my point. If we haven't seen the miracles of God, is it because perhaps we have not been wearying him in prayer? Notice over in John chapter 5 and verse 14. John chapter 5 and notice verse 14. He says, "Now this is the confidence." You can substitute faith in there if you want. This is the faith that we have. This is the realization that we have. This is the truth that we have. This is the understanding that we have. This is the promise that we have. This is the confidence that we have in him, that if we ask anything according to his will, he hears us. It's not a matter of God not hearing. The question is, does the answer always come immediately? If the answer doesn't come immediately, it doesn't necessarily mean it's a lack of faith. Sometimes things happen and occur for a reason. Sometimes we are tested and tried. Sometimes there is a need to be obedient. But do we really stop and ponder and realize that perhaps the miracles are there, and because they're not happening in the way that we may see them or want to see them, we feel that they aren't happening? Let's ask the question, why do we not have the miracles that we have today as we do back in the time of Moses, as we do back in the time of Elijah or Christ? We do have the miracles in small scale. Again, as I said before, I shared that story with you of the extended session because it was miracle after miracle that saw us through. But we don't see these miracles of this tremendous magnitude. Why? Is it possible that a miracle like that would put the church in a spotlight for undue persecution at this particular point in time? You remember the statement that Jesus Christ gave to his mother when she wanted him to change the water to wine. Fix the problem. "Woman, my time, my hour has not yet come." Perhaps God is waiting because he does not want to put the church in the spotlight for persecution. That time will come, and we need to be prepared for it. Perhaps God is just not ready to do that just yet. In the meantime, what do we do? Do we say that the time of public miracles is gone? I would submit to you that it is not. I would submit to you that there are miracles that are occurring throughout the body of Christ. There are miracles that are occurring here in this congregation, here in all the congregations, if we look closely enough. Let's conclude by turning to Hebrews chapter 10. What is the prerequisite? What is the prerequisite that we need to have in terms of miracles? Are we looking too closely for them? Is it a matter that the miracle will strengthen my faith, and that I can have faith if I see that miracle? Jesus Christ addressed that. when he told them that it was a wicked and adulterous generation that sought after signs. The miracle occurs because it's a solidifying of our faith. Hebrews chapter 10 and verse 23 is where we need to go and think about the standpoint of miracles of God and do they exist still today. Hebrews 10 verse 23, he says, "Let us hold fast the confession, the confidence, the faith. Let us hold fast the confession of our hope without wavering." If we're looking for the miracle, we are wavering. Faith does not look for a miracle. The miracle will solidify the faith, but faith must be built step by step. Yes, the miracle will solidify it. Yes, it will strengthen it. But if we're seeking the miracle to have the faith, we've got the order backwards. "Let us hold fast the confession of our hope without wavering, for he who promised is faithful." That should be our moniker. We cannot waver even if we do not see the miracle of God sometimes right in front of our eyes. Our faith will make us whole. We cannot question or doubt God's will when the miracle simply does not occur, or it does not occur in the time frame that we feel it should. Miracles of God still occur today. I submit to you that they are there. They are happening in every one of our lives, if we are looking closely enough.